Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are undertaking a mission, really, focused on a concept that goes completely against the grain of modern life.
Oh, absolutely.
It's this idea of subtraction leading to an increase. We're diving deep into the theological concept of dying to self, specifically looking at John chapter 12.
Verses 20 through 26, and a lot of the commentary around it. It's, you know, it's a concept that's so hard to grasp because our entire culture.
Everything
from wellness apps to, I don't know, corporate ambition. It's all built around maximizing and preserving the self.
Right. Self-care, self-advancement. Those are the highest goods we're told.
They are.
But the source material, it just immediately throws this high-stakes, real-world metaphor at you that flips that whole idea. It starts with the slogan, that others may live.
And that, of course, is the motto of the U.S. Air Force paratroopers. I mean, pararescuemen.
Yes.
Who willingly sacrifice their own safety, maybe even their lives.
Yeah.
So that others can survive. It's just this immediate, powerful picture of giving yourself away.
It sets up the whole argument, which is, at its core.
Yeah.
Unless you're willing to give up the life you're currently grasping, you can never fully enter into the life that's actually being offered.
That's the proposition, plain and simple. Unless you die to yourself, you cannot truly live for Christ.
Exactly.
And this whole profound teaching, it all unfolds because of a very simple and I think surprising request.
Okay, so let's get into how this all starts. It's almost like a little international incident. John 12, Koinewiki sets the scene. There were some Greeks in Jerusalem.
Right. They came up to worship at the feast, and they have one goal. They want to see Jesus.
And the context here is just so good. The sources remind us that just last week, we were talking about the Pharisees.
And they were complaining, right? They were saying bitterly, the whole world is going after him.
And here's the world literally showing up. Gentiles, these Greek visitors, at a Jewish feast. It's the prophecy coming true, whether the Pharisees liked it or not.
But they don't go right up to Jesus.
No, they seek out an intermediary.
And they go to a very specific person, Philip. And the commentary gives a few really compelling reasons for this. First, obviously, Philip is a Greek name.
Okay, so there's an immediate connection.
A connection. And second, he was from Bethsaida in Galilee, which was known for having a big Greek population. He'd be culturally familiar.
He speaks their language.
Yep.
Maybe literally.
Maybe. And critically, Philip already had a reputation for bringing people to Jesus. He's the one who brought Nathanael. He was their bridge.
And the fact that they're even looking for a bridge, I mean, Philip then goes to Andrew, who also has a Greek name. It highlights what the sources call the VIP problem.
That's a great way to put it, because in their eyes, Jesus was absolutely a VIP. He's performing miracles. He's challenging the authorities.
He has huge crowds following.
Huge crowds. So they assume there must be, you know, a protocol, a security detail.
You need a special pass to get
in. Exactly. And you can't blame them, really. Jesus's ministry had been focused on the lost sheep of the house of Israel.
Right. On the Jewish people.
So as non-Jews, they're probably wondering, will he even see us?
And that raises such an important point that the sources say is still so relevant. We often set up a fence where God has made a freeway.
Yes. We see Jesus as distant or, you know, that we need to get ourselves cleaned up first or find the right person to introduce us.
We build these walls of religious protocol where the cross actually opened up a direct path.
It's a powerful idea.
So these intermediaries, Philip and Andrew, they bring the request to Jesus. But his answer, it's not what you'd expect. He doesn't talk about them at all.
No.
He says, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified."
And this is the pivot. The whole passage turns right here. He shifts the focus from who the seekers are, Jew, Greek, insider, whatever, to who he is.
The Son of Man.
The Son of Man. His identity is what grants access, not their background. The Greek showing up is the signal that his hour has finally arrived.
But I have to ask, what does he mean by glorified? Because for us, glory is, you know, triumph, power, victory. And we know what's coming next is the crucifixion.
That's the countercultural bomb he drops right there. The sources stress this over and over. For the Romans, for the Jews, the cross was the ultimate instrument of shame.
Public humiliation. Utter failure.
No one would ever connect crucifixion with glory. It was a spectacle of defeat.
So how does he redefine it?
For Jesus, glorified means a very specific sequence. His death, burial, resurrection, and ascension. The cross, the symbol of complete self-denial, it becomes the only pathway to ultimate honor.
Wow.
That is the triumph. That's the glory.
So the path to glory runs straight through the most radical act of self-denial imaginable, and he uses that specific term, Son of Man.
Which is a direct callback to the prophet Daniel.
Daniel 7.
Exactly. He's using that title to say that this sacrificial act is the fulfillment of Daniel's vision, where the Son of Man comes before God and receives dominion and glory and a kingdom.
And then comes the crucial part.
The crucial part. So that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. He's basically telling Philip and Andrew, see, the Greeks are here. It's happening now through my sacrifice.
That sets the foundation for everything that follows for us, which leads us right into the principle of fruit and that unforgettable analogy in verse 24.
Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit.
And that's the first result of dying to self. To bear much fruit.
Let's just break down that analogy for a second. A seed, you know, it's perfect in itself, but it's trapped.
It's isolated, alone, like he says.
It remains alone. It has to go through this process of being buried, of decomposition, a kind of death for it to germinate and produce a harvest.
And this applies first to Jesus.
First and foremost to him. He is the original grain of wheat. He has to die and rise so he can send the Holy Spirit, which is the only way believers can be empowered to live that fruitful life.
And then that call gets passed on to us.
It does. We're called to give ourselves away, to put others' interests before our own, to deny our own comfort or safety, to bless the people around us.
The kernel of us has to break open.
So that fruit can spring up from that denial.
To make this idea feel, I guess, a little more concrete, the source commentary brings up that example from,
yeah.
It's from Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah, Captain Barbossa. It's surprisingly perfect.
It really is.
Barbossa spends his entire life chasing gold. That is the ultimate pursuit of self. That was the life that he loved.
But then his daughter is in danger.
Right.
She's hanging from a chain, and she asks him, who am I to you?
And he just says, treasure.
He gets it in that moment.
He realizes in a split second that she is the real treasure. All the gold is meaningless. And to save her, he has to willingly let go of that chain and fall to his death.
He dies to the life he once loved.
That life of self-service so that she, the fruit, can live.
That's a powerful picture of the choice. It's not a small adjustment. It's a radical reevaluation of what you value most. And that brings us to the next section on service and reward, which starts with some really stark language in verse 25.
Yeah, it's language that's meant to get your attention. Whoever loves his life loses it, and whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life.
Okay, wait. Hates his life. That sounds extreme. For anyone listening today, steeped in, you know, self-love and self-care, that could sound really destructive.
And that's a crucial question, because we have to be so careful not to confuse this with psychological self-destruction or self-loathing. That's not it at all.
So what is it?
The commentary is clear. This is about allegiance. It's about perspective. It's a hyperbolic contrast between two ways of living. On the one hand, you have those who desperately grasp onto their present temporal life.
Their comfort, their security, their own satisfaction.
All of it. And in loving that life most, they ultimately lose their soul.
And the second group.
The second group are those who see their own temporal life as, well, as insignificant compared to the glory of Christ. They're willing to hate their grip on the world's promises.
So they set them aside.
You set them aside to secure the life that is truly eternal. It's all about where you believe true life is found.
So it's not about adding Jesus to your already self-focused life to make it a little better.
No, the source material really stresses this. Jesus is our life. There's no room for dual allegiance. You cannot serve two masters.
The call is radical. Deny self, take up your cross, follow him.
If your greatest desire is your comfort and safety in this world, then you're choosing to love the life that perishes. If your greatest desire is the glory of Christ, you're choosing the life that is eternal.
And that choice is tied directly to service. In the very next verse, if anyone serves me, he must follow me.
Serving and following, they're two sides of the same coin. You can't have one without the other.
And following means walking the path Jesus is on.
The path of complete self-denial, which is then shown or manifested by giving yourself away for the good of others.
And the source materials has a lot to say about what that service actually is.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just an activity.
It is not a once-a-week activity for an hour and a half on Sunday morning. That is not service. It has to be a pattern of life.
And that's the challenge for you, for the listener. How does that pattern actually show up in a modern, busy life?
In 1,000 daily ways. How you treat your spouse after a long, hard day. Your attitude when something inconvenient happens. How you use your money, your words, your time,
prioritizing someone else's need over your own convenience.
Exactly. If you are following Jesus on the path of self-denial, then every one of those daily interactions becomes an act of service.
That's a high bar. I mean, it's impossible with just willpower. But the end of this verse gives the ultimate comfort, the third result. Where I am, there will my servant be also.
And that is the ultimate promise of satisfaction. Notice, he shifts the focus from a place like a physical heaven to his person.
To being with him.
The reward isn't just a change of location. The reward is being transformed into his likeness. It's being with him, sharing his thoughts, his attitudes, his desires.
And that transformation is only possible because he first died and rose and sent the Spirit.
We don't achieve this by trying harder. We are empowered to follow. And then the final promise ties it all back to glory.
If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him.
Just as the Father glorified Jesus after his self-denial on the cross, those who follow that path of sacrificial service will be honored in the ultimate way. The reward is, it's eternal peace, complete satisfaction. It's the fulfillment of that paradox. To live is Christ, and to die is gain.
What a profound journey. We see that this choice, to die to the self we cling to, it's the only path to the life that truly lives and bears fruit.
So to summarize this whole deep dive for you, the learner, the material shows us that unless you die to yourself, you cannot live for Christ. But if you do embrace that path, the results are threefold.
Right.
You bear much fruit now, you keep your life for eternity, and you are promised to be with him in glory.
And as we reflect on this idea, this deeply countercultural idea, that the path to honor and fulfillment runs through denial and sacrifice, it raises a question for you to consider this week.
Yes. If the cross serves as a pathway to glory, what is one major cultural value in modern life that we treat as a badge of honor? You know, whether it's hyperproductivity or building a personal brand or financial independence, that might paradoxically require a form of death or denial to achieve true, lasting fulfillment.
Something to grapple with every day. Thank you for taking this deep dive with us.
Until next time, keep digging.